Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
From the editorial side, we use sound as a storytelling tool. So basically, it's all about storytelling. And it's about when do you want to be internal or external in a character. And from that moment, I only work with 8 audio tracks for simplicity.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Push the Envelope. I'm the AV Club's editor-in-chief, Patrick Gomez, and today we'll hear from the Oscar-nominated team behind Sound of Metal. But first, speaking of the Oscars, we're finally getting more of a picture of what the 2021 ceremony is going to look like on April 25th. And to break that all down with me is the AV Club's senior writer, Katie Reif. Katie, thanks so much for joining.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
Hi. I'm good. So as I mentioned when you joined us last, if people are interested in your take on Oscar nominations and all that kind of stuff, we actually are discussing that on the AV Club's other podcast, Film Club.
That's true.
Where you and our film editor, A.A. Dowd, are breaking down all of the big categories. And I want to ask you a little bit about that momentarily. But first, I want to give everyone a little bit of an overview of what we now know to expect when the Oscars air live on ABC on Sunday, April 25th. We are getting no host again, which I think we all kind of celebrate a little bit. I don't know how you feel, Katie, but I certainly think that that's the right way to go. As in years past, we're not going to have one major host. It'll just be different people coming out for different bits throughout the show.
Yeah, I'm happy with that. I mean, I can think of very few examples of an Oscars host that everybody liked. maybe just skip it.
Yeah, well, and the ones that we do like have done it so many times now that it's
that's
like,
true.
It would be a boring choice and it's everyone true. Would be like, oh, them again. Like, no, let Billy Crystal take a rest. Like, yeah. let...
Indeed.
Indeed. But, you know, while we won't have a host, they are beginning to release the names of the people that will be presenting throughout the night or appearing in different capacities throughout the night. So the names we have so far as of the recording of this podcast are Angela Bassett, Laura Dern, Halle Berry, Bong Joon-ho, Harrison Ford, Regina King, Marley Matlin, Rita Moreno, Joaquin Phoenix, Brad Pitt, Reese Witherspoon, Renee Zellweger, Don Cheadle, Bryan Cranston, and Zendaya. I think there's some names here that really excite me. I mean, who doesn't love a good Laura Dern moment?
Of course.
And obviously this list will grow and grow and grow in the coming weeks. I'm sure things are still being solidified. And one of the reasons that that has to be the case is because, you know, they eke out these names regardless because they know it gets press and attention leading up to the show.
And some of them you can predict because traditionally, like some of the awards will be presented by the previous year's winner.
Yes.
So, you know, like Brad Pitt, for example, will present this year's Best Supporting Actor because he won last year.
But what's interesting here is that, like, the component of the changing decisions at the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Science in terms of what they will allow in terms of the way that you can attend the ceremony. Because at first they were saying there was going to be no Zooms and everyone has to be in person and all this stuff that everyone was raising their eyebrows at. And while that does seem more realistic now that we are in the age of the vaccine being so readily available, certainly when they first announced those protocols, everyone thought it was not the right call and they did backtrack. So now we are going to get it's still a formal dress code, and for people to will be able to zoom in if that's what they have to do. But that being said, they are going to have performances and such filmed at the Dolby Theater, which is where the Oscars traditionally takes place, at least since 2002. In that theater also was formerly known as the Kodak Theater, so you may have heard it under that name. But we will have the main ceremony taking place at Union Station in the downtown Los Angeles area, which is a little bit of an odd choice, but people do have weddings and other festivities there. So it's not out of the question, but it certainly is a first for the Oscars.
Okay, let me ask. Yeah. I've been to Union Station a few times. Which part of Union Station is it going to be in? Because there's like, is it like that big front room with all the benches in it? Like, what part of the station are we talking about?
So that is traditionally where you would have a big event. So I'm imagining, okay. I have not read anything that goes into the specifics of where they're going to put everything. I could also see them using some of the outdoor space there. Uh-huh. Like there's multiple areas for them to use, but I would imagine that main lobby area is what's going to have the major like stage and where people will accept their awards and such.
Gotcha.
So we'll have a location at the Dolby, which is in the Hollywood area of Los Angeles. We'll have Union Station downtown, and then also locations in Europe and the UK specifically. Mm-hmm. We'll have spots as well. So it will be interesting to see how that all plays out. You know, I think we had you on right after the SAG Awards, and we spoke about how polished it was that it was pre-recorded, and they're going for live. Mm-hmm. and so they're going from live from all over the world, and we've seen how that's worked at some of the other shows. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out with this ceremony.
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of figured, for me, the big question mark was always international travel. Mm-hmm. And I am not surprised that they kind of loosened they added the London location. That makes sense. And then, you know, I imagine someone like Bong Joon-ho will come in over Zoom since he's based in South Korea. It's like, you know, the CDC has given vaccinated people the green light to travel within the United States, but a lot of these nominees don't live in the United States. And that to me was always the big question mark about the you have to show up in person thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was the right call. You know, I think we've seen the Oscars come out right after other big life events, big national tragedies, and all that kind of stuff. So they are certainly used to navigating waters that are difficult in terms of celebrating art in the face of adversity. Mm-hmm. That people are paying attention to. And for a while, I thought they were heading in the wrong direction here. And so I'm glad to see them course correct and make it mm-hmm. something that's more accessible to everyone, because I think it's a little irresponsible to force people to travel all around the world right totally. Now.
Yeah, yeah. The international bit was the part that kind of made me go, are you sure that this is a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, because then at that point, you're like, well, then should we even be doing this at all, you know, given all of that. So I'm glad they landed in a place that I think is more responsible.
Right.
But of course, you know, all of this is just the dressing. What we'll all be talking about the day after, barring any sort of major screw ups, will be the winners. And that's something that you and A.A. Dowd, our film editor, as I mentioned, have been discussing on our podcast, The Film Club. I don't want to give things away. I definitely want people to go and give those recent episodes a listen. But you're in the middle right now of a series of episodes that dig into the nominees in the way that we haven't pushed the envelope in the past for the other awards. We've had you come on and speak about SAG and Golden Globes, and so now you and Dowd are doing that over on Film Club, since that is our film-specific centric podcast. Mm-hmm. So I encourage listeners here that want to hear our in-depth takes of the categories to go take a listen to the last few episodes there. We've already had episodes featuring the supporting actor and actress categories, the screenplay and director categories, and coming up in the episode tomorrow, or if you're listening to this not on day of release, on Friday, there is the actor-actress, best actor-actress categories you'll discuss, and then next week we'll be getting best picture in the days leading up to the big ceremony. What's that process been like for you all? Are you agreeing a ton? Are you finding often that you both have different front runners?
What's interesting is that we tend to agree on who the front runners plural are, but who our picks are tend to diverge. Like, for example, we both think that, you know, the chances of Vanessa Kirby winning for Pieces of a Woman are pretty slim. But we were split on whether Frances McDormand or Viola Davis were going to win the award.
Ah, got you. Well, mm-hmm. it's super interesting there. I think it's great that you dug into screenplay and director, which mm-hmm. I think particularly director, it'll be interesting to see who comes to rise there. We've had front runners in all of them, but this is one of the years that I think we're going to get more surprises, or not even surprises, but that more categories are up in the air than usual. I don't know. Is that something you agree with?
I would agree with that. Yeah. And I think that something that's come up a lot is kind of the changing demographics of who's getting nominated for awards. You know, like we have acting categories that are dominated by people of color, which is a pretty new development for the Oscars. And having more than one woman nominated for Best Director is a new kind of trend for the Academy Awards. But something that I think has always been part of this conversation, that is something that we've talked about at length, is the kind of divide between where you have certain names that show up again and again, like, you know, Glenn Close, Anthony Hopkins, Gary Oldman. They're all in the running this year and they come up a lot. And then you have new people like Maria Bakalova was someone we talked about at length because she's kind of a left field pick.
I'm rooting for the girl. I think it's great. I also think it's interesting, though, you know, I've mentioned this a few times that, you know, perennial nominees like Meryl Streep had multiple opportunities and we don't see them represented in a lot of these awards this season and such. So it's been a very interesting year for nominees. And I think that the pandemic is a major factor there. I'm a big fan of spending my very small amount of idle time imagining what if scenarios and just how different this list of nominees would have been had we had a more traditional year of the films that were intended to have come out over the past 12 months.
Yeah, absolutely. There were some movies that ended up getting delayed that we probably would have seen come up. And yeah, some movies that are the front. I think this year, just the fact that a movie like Nomadland is the front runner is something that I would not have predicted if you had asked me, you know, at the beginning of the season, looking at what was going to come out. I would have been like, well, you know, it's probably going to be Mank, Trial of Chicago 7. It's like you have the expected this year, but you also have some more unexpected things mixed in. And the unexpected things seem to have kind of an edge over the expected, which is different. And perhaps a reflection of the unprecedented year that 2020 was for film, like you said.
Yeah, there's very few silver linings to this past year, but, you know, we will take them when we get them. One other change is the sound nominees this year. Mm-hmm. No, traditionally, it has been two categories for sound, one sound mixing and one sound editing. And we now are getting one category, best sound. They're kind of wrapping everything together. And this was, to be honest, something I had to kind of look into when that happened, because, you know, to me, it's like, oh, okay, like maybe we don't necessarily need them announced during the ceremony. I think, you know, as it runs super long, they've made the call to, you know, include some during the ceremony and move some to the technical awards and only include pre-recorded announcements for some of them and that kind of stuff. And I think that that's unfortunately a necessary thing. I wish we could do all of them and get to give everyone equal play, but that's just not the case for a televised event like that.
Right.
But, you know, the more I read into the combination of these categories, the more even the people in the sound world in film agreed that it was perhaps time to do that for something like the Oscars, because there are separate awards for the sound, you know, the sound community, I guess, I'm
sure.
For lack of a better word. They have their own awards that break it down into, you know, dozens of categories in terms of dialogue versus background. You know, there's all these different categories that you could break it down to. But the feeling was that because sound is so digital now, the way that it's created for film, that the duties of mixing and editing are very much combined when you look at it holistically, and that in the same way that we don't necessarily differentiate between set design being how did you build something that's on a soundstage versus how did you dress a set of a house that already existed. You know, the average viewer is not differentiating between that. So in the same way, they think, you know, if we look at sound holistically for a film, it makes sense to do that and honor it in that way, because that's how most people are enjoying sound in a film.
Yeah, absolutely. And that makes... I was kind of wondering if the reason that they combined them was because the technology had changed. And it sounds like that was a big part of it.
Yeah. And, you know, you recently spent some time speaking with someone that is nominated in that category mm-hmm. this year. As I mentioned up at the top of the episode, we're going to be hearing from some of the Oscar-nominated team behind Sound of Metal. We got to hear from the star, Riz Ahmed, in an early episode of Push the Envelope, which was fantastic. But you got to sit down with Nicholas Becker, who is the sound supervisor, and Mikael E.G. Nielsen, who is the film editor, also nominated for Sound of Metal this year. And got to speak to them about their roles in making what I think is one of the best films of the year, and clearly the Academy does as well.
Yeah, I think this one, we didn't discuss sound as its own category on Film Club, but if I was asked for my front runner in the category, I think Sound of Metal would be it. Because the sound design is so far forward in this film, it's such an essential part of the film. You know, like, it's always, of course, it's always essential to the film, but it's really a part of the storytelling in Sound of Metal in a way that you don't see all that often.
It's almost its own character. Mm-hmm. I mean, or at the very, you know, I think a term that I've used in discussing the film here on Push the Envelope in the past is it's almost a 4D experience. you know, I mean, we consider sound part of our of a normal film experience, but it, as you just mentioned, it makes it something you are super conscious of the entire time, and really makes you feel what the character is going through in a way that very few films in the past have done, I feel, which is super exciting. So it was fantastic to have you speak to both Nicolas and Miguel. I will say, as we head into the audio of this, if you are hearing a French accent, that is Nicolas, the sound supervisor, and the Danish accent is Miguel, the film editor. So keep that in mind as you're hearing these voices. But let's take a listen to Katie's, I thought, very, very interesting conversation with those two gentlemen.
So first, I just wanted to start maybe with a little bit of a softball question. So are either of you guys into metal music?
Sometimes.
Yeah. No, I had a period where I did like a lot of a black metal experimental band called Om from Brooklyn. But yeah, it's need to be very specific, you know. I don't like any kind of metal or music, you know.
So this was kind of, was this kind of a new world, you know, working on a film about musicians? And were there any kind of new challenges that you faced having, you know, the band plays live in the film and things like that? Did that present any challenges for you?
No, I think what was super important for us and for Darius, it was the fact that this band would need to play live, you know, and the fact that Soriz and Olivia, they learn from, you know, learn how to play these things. And also it have been composed to for them to be able to be played, but also to be very impressive. So it was a big work Abe did with a Pharmacon, a musician from New York, to actually create this first piece of music. So I think, yeah, it was very important because I think we wanted really the actors to have a physical engagement, you know, like to in the film.
Well, the physical engagement is a very important part of this film. Tell me a little more of this concept of body sound. I believe that was something that you and the director worked on quite a bit, Nicolas.
I think it's also because I'm recording everything I'm using in a film. So I as a Foley artist, or I'm doing field recording and white tracks, you know. So for me, everything I'm recording is linked to a moment of my life, you know. And so for me, there is a, you know, when I listen to this sound, it's giving me back a kind of physical memory, you know, like it's linked to a physical memory, you know. And I think that's the way I'm working, you know. And I try not to use the sound in maybe in a, you know, classic way, but I try to create a very physical aspect of the sound, you know. And I think I would love the audience to be able to remember some moments, not in a film, but from their life, you know. I try to reconnect, you know, to make a connection between the experience of the audience and their experience as people, you know, as person in their own life, you know. So I think it's need to be direct, you know, like it's need to be a direct sensation, a physical sensation, you know, and not something illustrative, you know, but something very, very straightforward.
Is that connected to the idea of the film trying to convey the experience of a deaf person?
What I want to say is that, for example, we were very documented to try to actually made this sound very right, you know, in the fact that when you become you're losing hearing, you start you still receive some sound, but through your tissue and your bones, and your brain is transforming that to a sound, you know, And I think everybody knows this because it's even when you talk, you know, we can hear the resonance of our body, you know. So I think like everybody know, you know, that feeling, you know, this kind of inner sound, you know. So I think it's even if people never experience hearing loss, you know, they can feel that it's right in a way. You know, it feels right, you know.
You mean like, for example, how you can hear, like if it's very quiet, you can hear your heart beating in your ears, that type of thing?
Exactly, you know, that's also the experience when Darius came the first time to Paris to meet me. We went together in an echoic chamber. It's a place where there is absolute silence, you know. And then after 10 minutes, you start to hear everything, you know, your heartbeat, your blood pressure, your tendons. So the limitation of your ear, you know, like the hiss in your ear. So I think it was very important to have this experience and to try to recover this moment through, you know, the journey of the film. So we did a lot of recording with Riz, you know, when there's this scene with when he come to see the audiologist, there's a booth, you know, and after the shooting, I spend like we stay with Riz like, for 2 or 3 hours. And I bring some stethoscope mic, geophone on his skull, a mic in his mouth, you know. So I was able to record, like, you know, the internal life of Riz. And that's the material we actually used to recreate that kind of sequence. And that's the material I gave also to Mikkel, you know, to be able to actually edit with this material. Because I think it's very important to get the right sound because you get the right feeling. And I think if he was only using the sound, which would be like more generic or more random, you know, in a way, it wouldn't have the right feeling with it.
Right, like you weren't using a sound library.
Yes, the idea that normally it's happened quite often that the picture editor work with his own library. But I think it's a bit strange for me because I think it's much better for the editor to get exactly the library from which have been created for the film, you know. And also because, you know, the fact that what he's doing, the way he's editing, it's a base. It becomes the base of my work. So it's also a way to respect, you know, the work of the editor. And in this way, I think it was not so much editor accept that kind of collaboration, you know. But Mikkel, he was very simple, you know, and he was also like we create a protocol where for the cochlear implants, you know, at the end, his assistant was able to process the sound, so like that he was autonomous, so he was able to actually create, you know, the right material for him to be able to work with and to get the right feeling, because I think if you're not it seems like, for example, I'm doing a new film now and the editor decided not to integrate the sound I gave to her. And now she's very surprised by the feeling, you know, she's like, oh, it's going too fast. Oh, it's going too slow. Oh, it's, you know, and you know, it's the way, I mean, like Mikkel, he knows that, you know, he knows that changing sound will change the perception of the picture editing. So for him to integrate the sound I give to him and for me to use what he has done as a base of my work, it's very simple process, but it's very right, you know, I think. Even more because this film has a kind of a documentary aspect, you know, so it's important to feel that it's right, you know, and true all the time.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like you were really going for the kind of truth of physical experience, and that is something that is very individual.
Exactly. You know, because I think not in that case, because Darius was very, very, he has an incredibly large amount of tools to work. You know, he's able to work with the costume, with the light, with everything, you know, everything. He can use everything. But I think... As a sound designer, you know, most of the time your relation is let's say more illustrative, you know, and I think that it's become very quickly redundant. So what I'm trying to do is not to work in another level, you know, to create another structure which will be more physical, you know, and knowing that I mean, it's a bit like, I don't know how you call that, but there is a cake in France called like the 1,000 leaves, you know, where you have like a lot of, you know, and the idea is that if you got like a lot of lines built, like, you know, in very different domain, I think you can really after remove, you know, a lot of part of it. And it's creating a complex waving. It's never redundant, you know. At one moment the picture is leading, at one moment the actor is leading, at one moment the sound is leading, you know. It's bring a lot of complexity and a lot of, it's become very organic, you know, I think.
Right. Mikhail, on the sort of picture editing side, it was your job to kind of take all these different layers and combine them. Were you working with many, 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 many tracks like he was talking about, or did you kind of have to combine them into audio tracks?
No, I mean, so from the editorial side, we use sound as a storytelling tool. So basically, it's all about storytelling, and it's about when do you want to be internal or external in a character. And from that moment, I only work with 8 audio tracks for simplicity. And simplicity, less is more. And there's a beauty in the right atmosphere that can just stand still, and then you can have your dialogue as a mono track almost. But from what I got from Nicholas was that I got all the atmosphere, and I would work with that almost as the soundscape for the film and for the scenes. So it would become much more of an emotional journey, almost like the film score. And we would use those feeds from the first opening concert. And you would use those into this internal, external feeling of Ruben. And from a story perspective, it's about finding the right language to get you as an audience into the head of Ruben. And it's not about the quality of the sound. It's more about how do you feel when you are connected with Ruben, and how much do you actually know? Are you allowed to know more than Ruben, or are you not allowed to know more than Ruben? And if you don't know more than Ruben, you feel you're going on the same journey as your main character. So that's always the balance. And then from all these tests and knowing that Nicholas can create the feeling, because the whole idea of using sound as a storytelling tool is extremely powerful, because it becomes physical. And it becomes something that you become very aware of going into the head of your main character. Especially if you are not being able to understand what's going on in the scenes. And you feel and you lose the sense with your main character throughout the film. Up to the point where he leaves you, which is the midpoint on the slide scene with the boy. And that slide scene opens a whole new world to Ruben, as you saw it up in the start. And he leaves you, and you're left with him speaking sign language, and everything will be subtitled from that moment. And you see it from there. So he goes ahead, he has a project. You don't know about his project. But up to that point, you actually know what's going on with your main character. And all that is created with the thing we called awakening the senses. Awakening your senses with you being able to listen, you being able to watch, us only telling you very, very little in the thing. So you have to be aware of these small details, because those details will become very important throughout the whole film. And if we have created a contract with you, how we go in and out of the head of Ruben, or how we can go from external to internal in one shot, like a dolly track up at the start, there's 3 of them, then it can become emotional when you go into the cochleus, when Lou and her dad are singing in the end. So that's how we work with the sound as a storytelling tool from an editorial perspective. And it became almost like a blueprint for Nicholas and in the mix, how to work with the sound. Obviously, there's tons of hours how to make the quality of the sound. But for me, it's much more about what does the scene do with the scene? Are we supposed to be internal, not knowing what's going on with how much information do we give in the scenes then when we go external?
Right. And that's a storytelling decision, then, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, because that's where you feel that you go with your main character. and you not being able to know what's actually going on. You having the same emotional feeling as your main character when you see someone talking to you and you don't know what he's saying, it almost becomes like a horror movie in the pharmacy scene. And suddenly you cut out and you hear the word doctor, and he's like all looking right, doctor, and you cut into that internal again. So you become frustrated with your main character. That's where we use the sound as a storytelling tool to tell you what kind of story is this going to be.
There is, I think also the sound, the way it's mixed after, it's also helped to have a kind of strategy of attention, you know. At one moment, you want focus on just like a scratch on the end, and sometimes you want to give a much more larger scale, and then after you know, like there's a lot about also the idea of how the sound can actually push the people into going into the picture or going out of the picture, just look at something or you know, like I think it's a kind of very interesting game, you know, between the audience and the mix, you know, and the sound and the picture.
And it's also what's interesting is that it shouldn't be that you shouldn't be aware of these changes. You should much more be aware that you are put in the perspective of a character. So you feel, which is why you feel that the sound is extremely important to the film, because you feel it with him. You lose the sense with him, but you also gain a sense with him when they open the cochleus.
But you know, also I spend like maybe a huge amount of time of the first scene, the concert, to make it really good, you know, because we knew that it's going to be super important when they decide with Mikkel and Darius to put this scene as the first scene. We knew that it's going to be super important, you know, so we spend a lot of time on that. And also we spend a lot of time with Mikkel, and mostly Mikkel, to find the arc, you know, or the general arc of point of hearing, point of viewing, you know, and how to combine both things. In terms of the sound editing is not very complex. Yeah, no, it's complex, but it's more the structure which is complex. You know, you don't have like 500 tracks and you know, but it's more about the structure and how much time we spend to find exactly the right structure, you know, of that. You know, it's more about how to write the sound more than to put a lot of sound, you know, in each scene, you know. I think I really like to work in that way, you know. For me, after putting sound is quite easy, you know, but to understand where you have to put sound, how you have to kind of understand the large structure and the arc of it, you know, it's what is more complex and more time-consuming, you know?
What was difficult for the film, for us to find in the film, was the whole structure and that circle of the film. And it's how to start the film with the concert, which was very late in the process. The edit process, it was very late that we put the opening concert as a start. But it created a whole different film, because it becomes like a circle for the whole ending. It's the exact same image of your main character sitting. One, he's eager and he's fixing. He's ready to go. And one, he's in complete silence. He's relaxed and he's also almost meditating. But it's the same character you see. And it has like there's a circle that it goes through that. And then from that on, it's about finding that language, how we put you as an audience into the head, or that you understand this is how we're going to tell you the story and this is how you're going to feel it. And from Darius's point of view, it was extremely important that we don't have cutaways, which is why the concert has to be, they have to perform for a live audience, and they have to be the one doing it, because by them actually doing it, you feel you are with them, you're present. It's not a lot of cutaways, a lot of shortcuts where you can see like a drum, snare kit or a guitar or anything. So we try to cheat and say that these are really good musicians or anything, which is how you normally would do it. But this is like a raw, almost like a documentary, and everything is seen from the perspective of Ruben, if you watch it again, the concert. But you also hear it from his perspective, from sitting on the stage with him on the drum kit. And then you have a hard cut. Everything has to be hard cut throughout the whole scene, because it's so aggressive and you go silent into that airstream. And then you start little by little. You show him looking out. You show an air dust. You show a smoothie. You show coffee dripping. You show that you yourself have to use your eyes and ears. And by little, and suddenly you cut everything away. With your main character, you stay in the image and he becomes deaf, but you feel you become deaf with him.
Yeah, and that, and early on, those scenes, the way that the sound drops out, so it's very distressing. The pharmacy scene, like you were mentioning, it's very distressing as an audience member.
But the pharmacy scene is the key to the whole film, because the pharmacy scene is the scene that tells you this language, how we can treat the material. But it's also where we create the rule for ourselves, what kind of scenes we can put afterwards, which was very interesting because we had a lot of different scenes that could do a lot of different things. And Nicholas and I tried a lot of ways. Can we go in and out, or can we show internal perspective from other in other variations instead of a side shot, or how can it be? But by finding the language, and the language has to be as simple as possible, but that's also the most difficult part, to find that simplicity. So you don't think about it. You just feel that you are with your main character. You shouldn't think that I do the cut or that it's flashy or anything. You should just feel present with your main character.
I think the fact that you can we work together, it creates a structure which is more complex, so it's more organic. So I think for me, that's what is so important for me, what we did together, you know, with Darius, because Darius was spent also a lot of time with us. So let's say the three of us, we really work together to create that. And I think that if you don't do that, it's going to, it sounds and it looks like that because we did that, you know. I think the fact that it was you know, like we worked together on that, it creates the language. You know, that's the collaboration we had together who creates the complexity of the language, you know, and you couldn't have done that separately. And I think it's very, for me, it's very important, you know, because when I started to work 30 years ago, most of the time it was like people from the picture department which were doing sound, because it was simple to do, but they also, they have a knowledge, they knew the secret of the film, you know. And for a moment, everything have been super separated, you know, like specialized, you know, and I think something have been lost. So actually, to try to work in that way, I think we'll come back to this kind of, the idea of the editing is an amazing tool. It can be sound and picture together, you know. So to be able to collaborate, you know, together, it's bring us back to the root of making a film, you know, and cinema.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that I imagine must have come up a lot is being immersive without being intrusive, because I feel the immersive sound design could have been kind of a flashy forward thing, but you keep it further back. And so, like you said, you feel the truth rather than really noticing, oh, look what they're doing with the sound design.
But because I think, as I said before, that's because we have been very naturalistic in a way, you know. I think if Darius and Abe, the brother of Darius, who co-write the script, they were very documented. And so we knew exactly how a lot of people describe hearing loss, you know. And I also, through some film like 127 Hours or Gravity, you know, that was ideas I've already experimented. Not at this level, but the idea of being inside, being in the inner world of a character, is something I've already tried to experiment, you know.
But also, if I can say, there's also the fact that if you want to tell a story where you feel with your main character and you go into a deaf community where you should feel that you sit in silence, or you feel surroundings and the landscape and the house and all these things, it has to feel organic. It has to feel how you would normally go. If you go out in the wood and stand and listen to the wood, that's how it feels and that's how it sounds. So the whole film is extremely organic up to the point where it becomes extremely metallic. And that's an idea that's a rule that creates simplicity again, because by not Nicholas can add, if you ask me if I have thousands of layers of sounds, but why would I? Because if you have the right stereo aspect of the right atmosphere, which is how you want people to feel and stand in the right sense and that right feeling, it's enough. That is the one. And it's so simple, but it's also just how you record it or how it feels or how you select that it goes with the leaves, or if you hear train out in the front, that you become aware of the feeling of everything. And the feeling is also the sound.
And if you want, for example, I'm doing a lot of multi-channel recording. It means that I've got a lot of microphone with a bit like different lengths, but in the same recording. So what I give to Mikel is like, let's say, one stereo, you know, but then me after when I took his editing, I reconform with the multiple microphone, you know, in the same recording, I can move to a very immersive sound, to something very precise. So instead of adding a lot of layer, it's a bit like I was able to zoom in the sound or zoom out and zoom in, you know. So I don't have a lot of sound, but, you know, I can actually change of point of hearing, you know. Also, we play that positioning, the subjective positioning, you know, in a lot of different position, you know, from the way I record sound. You can be closer to the heart, or you can be in the head, or you can be in the mouth, you know. So you can even move into the inner sound of the body, you know.
Yeah. That kind of relates to something that I was wondering about with this film. Because of the experience of losing hearing and the cochlear implant, a lot of sounds are muffled. And muffled sound can really make it difficult. It can be alienating, you know, because it can be difficult to understand what's happening. How did you work with the subtleties of that to make it, you know, a more experiential and not just, wait, what's happening? I can't hear.
Yeah, I mean, that's again about how much information do we want to understand in the scene, and should you feel like, wait, what's going on, or should you more feel like that here we're losing the sense of someone snoring, or should it feel like you can feel that the emotions of people banging on the table, but you can only feel it becomes almost physical for you, or you can feel that there's, like with the cochlear implants, in the end, how much can you actually stay in that world? And if you create the right feeling, and when do you leave Ruben in that sense that you understand that we hear everything from this perspective, but now we just go into the film when we meet his dad, because we want it to be extremely lonely or disoriented when he then walks out in the garden, for example, and all the sound sources come from all these different places. Obviously, there's a quality to how much can you actually understand, or how little can you understand these things. And that's in the sound mix as well, where you can play with it. How much do you want to hear? But it's all about that quality, that it shouldn't feel that it's something you become aware of. It should more be that you feel that you are there with him in that sense. And then it's about that he's losing more and more and more of his hearing when you go into these sensations.
For the cochlear implant, it was the opposite, you know. I mean, like, nobody should have the experience of it, you know, because it means that you have cochlear implants. So we try to, because there's Coda people who describe this thing, you know, how it sounds. So we try to be real, but also I try to create a sound which nobody has heard before, you know. Because it's totally the opposite. It needs to be like totally new, you know, something you have never heard. So when I try to create this effect, I really try to find a processing which people don't know, you know, which you don't use to hear, you know, not like guitar distortion, or not like stuff which are already existing in the memory of sound, you know, in the process, you know, the way you can process sound.
It becomes alienated. You feel alienated. You feel something you've never experienced it before. Where up to that point, you actually feel that you have heard your own, you have tried the feeling of tinnitus or being underwater and hearing everything very metallic. And that's where we start playing with these things, that you have actually experienced all these things throughout your whole life. Sometimes you put your ears and your fingers in your ears and you hear, and you feel this, but suddenly you feel it with him and you see him, which is why you are being put inside of the head of Ruben, and it works. But that was also the beauty of it, because that was Darius' intention, that he wanted deaf people to have an experience as a whole, because everything was closed captioned. but us as hearing person, we should feel left out. Suddenly, we see scenes where they are sign using sign language, and when you see it with deaf people, they start laughing because there's funny moments in these scenes. But you feel like, why is it not subtitled? What's going on? You feel disoriented, and that's the whole idea of the whole film, that you at a certain place should feel like, did I feel silence myself, or what is this about? It just points to the ending of him taking away the cochlear implants. And the silence, and we stay a little too long on the scene on Ruben, him looking at the different things, and you suddenly put yourself in the situation, and it becomes extremely emotional.
That's going to do it for this week's episode of Push the Envelope. But if you enjoyed that conversation with Nicolas and Mikael, you can check out avclub.com for a visual element to the interview in which Katie played specific scenes from the film and had them break it down in sort of a DVD commentary-esque way, both the sound elements and the editing elements in the creation of those scenes. So, of course, as I mentioned, you can check that out on avclub.com, as well as the Oscar ceremony to see if these guys win big when it airs live on ABC April 25th. You can check out me on social media at Patrick Gomez LA. And we will be back with an all new episode of Push the Envelope next week. Until then, I please ask that you like and comment and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And until next week, bye. This episode of the AV Club's Push the Envelope was brought to you by producer Michaela Heck and sound engineer Ryan Allen.